Commerce Committee to order. February 23rd, in the Fair and Capital Region Office, we have in front of us, the first bill today will be a proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 97, Labor and Commerce. Senator Pierce is sponsor. Did you want to testify on the bill, Senator?
I will. Are we on teleconference?
We are on teleconference to Anchorage. It's about that.
Hello, Anchorage, Mr. Dutton. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you bringing Senate Bill 97 up today, and as you stated, we do have a draft CS for the committee's working purposes. The board draft will enable emergency dispatchers to better assist people who call 911 when they find themselves in a threatening situation. Oftentimes, victims, particularly the young and the elderly, are unable to give adequate directions after they dial 911 to explain where they are and what the problem is. If enacted, the bill would create a mechanism to help fund and enhance 911 emergency reporting systems. The bill is permissive. It does not say that it has to do this. Benefits would be an immediate visual display of the location and telephone number of the caller to the dispatcher, automatic routing for the appropriate emergency response unit with a faster response time, and also curtailment of abuses of the system by being able to document who those callers are and deal with them directly. The bill gives immunity from liability, except for intentional acts of misconduct or gross negligence, to municipalities and the suppliers of 911 services. I introduced this at the end of the session last year. Both ATA and APD were in Juneau talking to us about the possibility of doing an enhanced service in Anchorage. This bill came as a result of that earlier interest. It's my understanding from Representative Almer that she had been working on a similar bill that she has chosen not to introduce, but I do know that the Juneau Police Department is very interested in that enhanced service, and I think we'll find that there's some interest statewide. Thank you. I believe that Josh from your staff and Ken Erickson from mine can probably answer any technical questions about the CS.
Okay, let's go to Soldatna. Is there somebody on the line at Soldatna that wanted to testify on this bill?
I just wanted to observe.
Okay, how about Anchorage?
Yes, Senator. I support the committee substitute to Kenai Peninsula Borough. My staff assistant, Bill Reeve, my legal staff, has worked with Mr. Fink and Mr. Erickson in working out some the issues we saw in the bill. We support the idea of a mechanism for funding the enhanced 911, adding it to the phone bill. We had been drafting legislation that would accomplish much the same thing and addressed a number of the issues. We're pleased with the substitute, the work draft. We find that the ability under the under 100,000 municipalities to go to 75 cents deals with some cost factors that we have. We don't have the economy to scale that the larger municipalities such as Anchorage will have on the equipment, and that helps alleviate some of that and still adequately fund the enhanced service. So we support that. We also support the taking this out of the Title 42 and putting this under Title 29 for municipalities. We believe that's the appropriate place, and that this allows the municipalities the flexibility to deal with this issue and obtain the funding to enhance their system.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please? I don't think we caught that.
Sure. I'm the Kenai Peninsula Borough Attorney, 144 North Binkley in Soldatna.
And again, I missed your name.
Tom Bedeker.
Any questions? Okay, how about Anchorage? Was there anybody on board in Anchorage who wanted to testify today?
This is Larry Crawford, with the City of Anchorage. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we basically support the bill. It does what we're interested in doing. We don't know if the 50 cents is appropriate or not, but I think for purposes of moving ahead, we should do that, and if we have any different information, we'll get back to you. Anchorage would support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crawford, what is the, I assume in Anchorage you're talking about ATU. Do the boundaries of ATU match up with the boundaries of the municipality of Anchorage?
Pretty much, but there are people in the Matanuska Telephone Association on Eagle River and Chugach. But bill, and I've talked to the people at ATU, and my understanding is that they could collect the fee as well for those people that aren't in the boundaries.
Oh, okay. So the way this bill, as you read it, a municipality only has the option of adopting it municipality-wide, and it crosses all the exchanges that cross the border lines of that municipality.
My understanding is that, you know, we would probably have an agreement with MTA and ATU to collect this if we chose that option.
Thanks, Larry. Any other questions? Okay, let's come back to Juno then, and John Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John George. We're here today representing the Alaska State Firefighters Association and the Alaska State Fire Chiefs Association. We strongly urge that you pass this bill out. We think it's desperately needed, and this creates a funding mechanism to create an enhanced 911 system. And that's really the bottom line, is a mechanism for funding. It's needed. We just need to get it funded. One concern, I believe, is addressed by the bill in the definitions of enhanced 911 system that includes personnel to operate the system, dispatchers and whatnot. And as I read the bill, that would be a permissive use of the fee, and I think that that's important also. Given budget cuts and whatnot, this is a good way to pay for the entire system and make it work. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Any questions? Okay, Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gordon Parker. I'm Director of Carrier Relations and Public Policy for ATU. I just wanted to say that ATU does support this bill, and I basically just came down today to answer any questions if you had any. In my previous incarnation, I was Executive Director of the Alaska Telephone Association, and before I left there, we did consider this legislation, and the other telephone companies in the state did endorse it.
Okay, thanks, Gordon. Larry Penny.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Larry Fanning, Fire Chief, representing the City Borough of Juneau. The City Borough of Juneau strongly supports this bill, but would like to offer a recommendation on a change, and that would be to address what an E911 system composes. If we're looking at a system where an emergency happens, a call is generated, is received at a public answering point, the PSAP, what I would like to suggest is that we take one step further and look at some sort of including language in the bill for communications to the emergency response units of what information is received at the public safety answering point. So that's not to say that we go out and buy all new radios for everybody, but just to say that emergency communications is part of a system. It involves the emergency begins, the phone call is made, is received at the public safety answering point. At the public safety answering point, they need to get the emergency units responding to the emergency. That the language in here include radio communications so those emergency responders can be notified of the event so they get to the scene.
Do you have language proposed there, or do you have a proposal amendment?
The section that I'm looking at is on page 7 of the work draft. Under 137-2, I don't have it conceptualized, but something to the effect of including essential communication equipment necessary for the success of the emergency response.
Okay. Then on line 22. What we could do, if the committee chose to, is scratch the word and, put a comma after software, and add and essential communications equipment. I feel comfortable doing that because of the limit on each of the lines, the 50-cent limit in the
page 5, lines 8 and 9. I'd like to know how that sentence states the area served by a system may be a city, a unified municipality, or all are part of the area within a borough. I'd like to know, does that mean that a city cannot serve part of a city, or a unified municipality cannot serve part of a municipality, but only a borough can serve part of a borough? I don't know if there's anyone who can answer that. That's how I read it, but I'm not sure that, you're appreciating confirmation.
Anybody answer that? Well, I don't have any volunteers.
Mr. Chairman, I would then move to amend my name to say, before the word city, put all of, before a city, and again, before a municipality, a unified municipality, put all of.
So you've done just that. Without objection, we'll do it. Okay, we'll need a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's a conceptual amendment if the director thinks that there's a better term for it than all of. That would be something that's technical.
Yes, sir. Okay, is there an amendment to adopt the committee sentences with the two proposed amendments? Is there a motion?
Also.
Are there any objections? Objection, the committee substitute is adopted. Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move, forgot to look at the fiscal notes. Is there a fiscal note? Zero? Labor and Commerce pass out CS, or SB 97, Labor and Commerce, with individual recommendations, a company or not a company, zero.
Objection, that objection is, three substitutes, SB 97, pass out Labor and Commerce. Next bill is the fee bill.
from the certification is typically paid by the individual?
We would expect it to be paid by the individual.
How much are we talking about? What's the recommendation?
$50 for every level of certificates. Probation.
Okay, it's a one-time fee.
One-time fee, yes.
And it does not affect anybody currently on board, correct?
That's correct, they're certified already. It would be after the effective date. We would expect it to be any person hired after the effective date.
And conceptually, committee would put $50 in statute for all police officers in the state. Okay, Rita Hensley. Senator Rieger wanted a list of exempt areas.
I did, oh, that's not attached to that. I do have that, I'll take it for you.
Why don't we come back to this? So any other list management? Fire. We haven't heard yet from risk management on this bill, but allows you to have it, why don't you give us an overview of what you're trying to accomplish?
My name is John Hitchcock, I'm the director of the Division of Risk Management. This bill, the portion of the bill that involves risk management is on page 19, section 62.
We worked out this page 18.
Mr. Chairman, the reason and the need for this suggestion came about because about 2 years ago, I guess it was, our insurance recoveries in risk management, which normally flow back to the general fund, they always flow back to the general fund, unless they're recoveries made in the same year that we pay them out or where they would return to our appropriation, were about $4.1 million. And there was apparently an audit going on from the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal section. The auditor, and incidentally, since then, I've concluded that most of my compatriots across the states are having the same problem. The auditor looked at the monies that we had recovered and said, how much of these are federal funds? Well, some of those claims recoveries are, you know, 6, 8, 10 years old. And it could involve a great number of claims with no idea. Their problem, apparently, is if we recover monies for risk management and they're returned to the general fund, they can be reappropriated to something other than paying insurance claims. And so it was concluded that if our recoveries flow directly into the catastrophe fund, which pays insurance claims, we would not have that problem with federal monies and with our recoveries. But is that clear, or have I thoroughly confused
you? Confused us.
Yes.
I'm looking, I know you're speaking to Section 62, but it seems to go hand in hand with Section 63. The language, that's letter D, that says the losses shall be deposited directly. That's so the purpose of that is to make it a direct deposit. Is that, are insurance claims and recoveries for losses always a reimbursement of money which was initially paid from that account, or in some cases, is there a claim or recovery for a loss where the original payment came right out of the general fund?
Through the chair, Senator, our appropriation consists of monies that we receive from allocation. At this time, we get no federal general fund monies. There are allocations from agencies. The catastrophe fund is an insurance fund set up as a safety cap for our insurance payments. In other words, if we exceed our appropriation in any one year, we have a safety cap so that we can pay claims. The balance of the year, that's what the catastrophe fund is all about.
How much is in the fund now?
Right now, I believe it's $4.1 million. We have used some of it this year for catastrophe loss.
Have you explained to us yet? You've got four sections, 61, 62, 63, and 64.
Yes.
Okay, could you explain 61 to us?
Let's see, 61.
Was it again deposited prior to this?
The monies. Let me go through this. Let's say that we have an aggregate loss policy in the amount of $8 million for the state. In any one fiscal year. What that means is that we have bought an insurance policy that guarantees that the state will not pay any more than $8 million for claims occurring in that year. The reaching that $8 million may take 4 or 5 or 6 years. $8 million. And any monies we pay out in addition for claims that occurred during that policy year, we put in a claims for through our aggregate insurance policy. And we can be reimbursed for claims in excess of $8 million. Now those, to a large extent, those are the kind of recoveries that we're talking about.
Okay, any other questions? I'm thoroughly confused.
Well,
the question is, do you trust the administration on this one?
That's what I know. And presently you said that the feds want some assurance. I mean, that it, this is what they want, because then it assures that we are using the money according to their criteria, or?
The Division of Audit, Department of Health and Human Services, says that if these claims paid were originally paid out in support of insurance programs that were supported by federal money in part, then if we make recovery of paid claims, they want their percentage of the recovery.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do this. Don, can you get this to us in writing?
Sure.
Why don't you give us a one page on the wrong understanding of what we're doing?
Chairman, we'll do that. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, we have $4.1 million in the account now. Is there a cap, or do we just keep building and building and building? Or
what? Through the chair, there's $5 million cap to the catastrophe.
So then that C does relate to D. That's a $5 million cap. It says set in B.
The C would cap the amount of money that we can retain in the catastrophe fund. Yes.
What happens if you cap that? I mean, if you get to five.
And then go over that?
Yeah.
We go back to general fund. Any money in excess of that, that wasn't encumbered, would go back to general fund.
Okay, thank you, Dad. We appreciate all the information for that, so that we can explain it if we were asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Services for the Division of Motor Vehicles. I believe there was two questions asked the last time. One was, what would be the, under Section 56, what the criteria would be that the department would establish regulations to exempt a person from paying the $10 additional fee. The $10 additional fee would be waived if the department required the person to physically come into the office. We would require a person to physically come into the office if they need to clear a non-sufficient fund check, if there was a stolen status on the vehicle, if they required a lien change or a title change to the vehicle. Those would be the things that we would waive the fee on. Senator Rieger had a question regarding exempt areas of the state. The list that I provided is all the areas that DOT has supplied to us that have fewer than 499 daily car traffic. And these are areas that are not connected to a state-maintained land-connected highway system. What area is not connected to a state-maintained highway system?
Okay, that brings us to Section 66 and 67. Is there
believe that you had a question in regard to the section on public facilities. You have to know what the definition of public facilities are. That includes restaurants, bars, markets, food processors, childcare facilities, residential care, schools, preschools, barber and beauty shops, toilets and showers, fresh air providers, and pools and spas.
Essentially, it's everything in the state.
It's at your house. Everything is within our statutory and our that does exclude most of these facilities within the municipality. It excludes most of these facilities within the municipality of Anchorage. They collect rural.
They have our own inspection.
That's correct.
This is a major then, major expansion of your inspection procedure statewide.
No, we already inspect those facilities at the current time. We just don't have authority to charge a fee.
Did you ever find out what the, we know what the fiscal note is there at this?
The fiscal note?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yes.
Resources note the other day when I made the hearing. It was 26 people.
Let's take some public facility, like from the list that you just listed. Let's say the restaurants at some restaurant in Cooper Landing or somewhere, and you inspect there. Now, what type of fee would they be charged? How much? I mean, does that, I should be able to take that right out of here, but I don't see that.
At the present time, we do have statutory authority for restaurants. We're not asking for that authority. And the present fee would depend on the city. It's a sliding scale depending on the city. And I don't have that schedule.
That's all in
regs? That is presently in our regs.
So the statute, oh, that presently is in your regs? But I thought you just said we're not collecting fees for it now. We're doing it, but we're not collecting fees.
There are some that, this is, this year is to include all of the additional public facilities that we presently do not have authority for. I believe Ms. Senator Kelly's question was, what are public facilities?
Uh-huh.
At the present time, we do have authority for certain public facilities, such as restaurants, bars, and stores, and food processors.
Which included fees or just authority to inspect?
No, that included fees.
I see. So this bill, though, vastly expands that list of people from whom you can collect fees and inspect. Or
that's
both.
Correct. We presently inspect them, but are not collecting fees.
Okay. I mean, I kind of like some, a little bit more of an idea of what kind of fees. Can you provide us with, you know, some examples?
Fees. Certainly.
Okay.
Senator Freer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm recollecting my thoughts from last time on this. Is Section 67 the Clean Air Act inspection provisions? Senator Pierce, $6 million fiscal note for a section of the Clean Air Act administration. How many permittees are we talking about that amount of money to be spread over?
I don't know the information I can get for you. It's my understanding that what we're asking for now is the authority to collect indirect costs, which we are required to do by the Federal Clean Air Act. We do presently have the authority to collect on direct costs. But we would like to know how many facilities we're talking about.
Well, actually, maybe a suggestion to the chair. I understand it's a Clean Air Act bill moving through the legislature. And that's where the fiscal note is, and the discussion of what facilities are subject to it. It might be Section 67, or whatever comes out is more appropriate attached to that bill. When I hear millions of dollars approving the collection of fees, it makes me nervous that we're approving something that could be much more than we think we're approving.
Here's the clear answer.
Mr. Chairman, did you already go over Section 65? The fees in parks, visitor center?
Yes, we did. You got a question?
I guess the question that I've got is that there's so many mays in here that I'm not sure who it is that it says may charge or collect a fee in a park unit. That some of the areas that I serve, there are the state parks, and there's a little box there with an envelope that says, please deposit $4 and show this little sticker on your window. And every time I went through the facility, no one had a little sticker on their window, and there was wood provided, et cetera, et cetera. How do you propose under this section to, I don't know who to even ask here. Is there someone to ask?
The Division of Parks. We didn't ask him to be here today, Senator, because we didn't realize that question would come up. Josh, what did you talk to Senator Lincoln in the next couple of days and see if we can help him with the question?
Thanks.
drop this and bring it back up. Well, what's the feeling of the committee on dropping the EDC stuff out of the bill?
I'd be happy to do that.
Pardon?
I'd be happy to do that.
Give you an introduction as to leading up to the drafting of the bill, and ask Jeff Bush to join me, if he may, to give you an in-depth steps of how we proceeded to put it together and what it is that we did put together. The changes of the Alaska Banking Code were determined to be necessary because of the changing in the industry, and there's three major points that I would like to just a brief introduction. First, that there was a changes in the marketplace. In 1969, when I first came to Alaska under the department, deposit insurance was $20,000. It jumped to $40,000, $60,000, then $100,000 in a short period of time. At that time, we had a regulation Q, which meant that there were 5.5% was the most commercial banks could charge on savings accounts. Today, that's an open market. We deregulated the liability side of the balance sheet of banks, but not the asset side. And then there was an onslaught of regulations. Regulation C, RESPA, Regulation EE, Fair Credit Reporting, CRA, Regulation CC, and Regulation O, and on and on. But what the biggest problem was with our banking code is that it just didn't address what was going on in the market at that particular time. It didn't address the like the cash management account, the non-banking financial institution like Sears, AT&T, General Motors, and on and on and on. So the division decided that these are things that are some of the things that need to be addressed in the existing banking code. While we were working on this as a division, we had a new commissioner, Commissioner Glenn Olds, that came on board, and he saw a vision that, that we should take immediate action as far as some of the activities in the old banking code. He wanted us to work on a process that would allow international banks to have a better entry into the Anchorage area for several reasons. One of them was that it would give a positive aspect to the development of natural resources. In other words, if a Korean bank came into Anchorage, that Korean bank may represent then its Korean customers in the as far as the coal industry and forest, the fishing industry is concerned. And the same way with other Far Eastern countries. There were other advantages that we were looking at that we could offer by having a stronger international banking code, and that is the possibility of having some location of international banks as far as time zone benefits to the Anchorage and fiscal benefits as far as a more centralized location between money centers and money markets in the world. So Commissioner Olds gave me the project of moving this thing as quickly as possible to recodify the banking code. And that we did. In 10 months, we were able to consolidate some of the thoughts that we had accumulated over a period of time. We asked for a capital expenditure to bring on some assistance on that, and we did that in the form of Jeff Bush, who was known by the practice. Mr. Bush was our counsel during, I think, for about a 10-year period of time, which he worked under the existing banking code and worked on some of the areas where we were having problems with failed institutions. We had three individuals bid on that position. All three of them were good. Judas Brett was one of them who bid on it, who is now in private practice. He used to be the director of the Division of Banking Securities. And Bill Green, who was with Arnold Lustig for many years, also bid. The competition was a good competition, and Jeff Bush came out ahead of that. Jeff's assignment was a little interesting. We took a little different approach on this. We did not want to re-regulate financial institutions. One of the things that you will notice in the proposed bill is that we have a repeater for Savings and Loan Act. The Savings and Loan Act, the last Savings and Loan Act, is very detailed on the types of real estate loans that they can make and how they can make them and under which provisions they were addressed. With all of those statutes spelling out the types and the amounts and the collateral of everything loans, we lost three savings and loans. It was an enabling statute which really did not give any good provisions for strong action in cases where there was deterioration. Now, the reason that we're asking for the appeal is that we still have a Mutual Savings Bank Act, ASO 615. That is a Mutual Savings Bank Act, and we have a Mutual Savings Bank, Mount McKinley, Mutual Savings Bank in Fairbanks. Their president called me one time, and he said, "What is it that I'm trying to do with this new banking code?" And I told Mr. President Ingham that all I want to do is make everybody do what he has done. He did very well. He did adequate during the banking crises. Another reason for repeal of the Savings Bank Act is that it's triple regulation. They would be regulated, any state charter would be regulated by the Office of Thrift Supervision, be regulated by FDIC, and be regulated by the state. some voice in this. And incidentally, they are the survivors of the recent banking failures. So, again, we feel very confident in their judgment. At this point, Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce Mr. Boyce. Thank you. Thank you. Now, the language will take us starting on the banking call.
Mr. Chairman, since there's a little bit of a break here, I don't know if I have a conflict at all with the committee or not, but I just feel I should let the committee know that I am a party to the lawsuit between FDIC and United Bank Alaska. So if there is a conflict in this discussion, please let me know.
I'm not aware of any. My general approach, as you know, having looked at the bill, it is, I think, 99 sections right now is the draft that came out of legislative affairs. Rather than going through it section by section, I thought that it might be more helpful for the committee to sort of go through it in under the general major significant substantive sections, of which I broke it down to 10 or 12 different subject headings. And then I can highlight where in the draft you can find these particular sections. That you should all have a sectional analysis, I believe, probably in your packets of the bill, based upon the 1993 work draft. And that gives more details of each individual section and the changes that are in each one. I'd like to point out, actually, before I start, there are two corrections to be in the sectional analysis. That, as you know, this legislative affairs draft didn't come out until the very end of last week, and then the special analysis has to be put together. It's being ran on immediately based on the new draft, and I missed a couple of
branches of banks in the state of Alaska, so that a bank from Korea would be allowed to purchase a bank or a branch of a bank here, or a bank from the state of Washington could, or any other state could.
Can you do that now?
Yes. Part of the problem is, although they can do a lot of these things now already, it's not spelled out. It's only that they can do it because of the absence of any sort of declaration in the law that there's been this determination that they can do it, although there's been sort of no interest in doing it that we've noticed. This will specifically spell out the rules of the game. This would spell out the rules of the game in those cases. Furthermore, an international bank would be allowed to establish a branch here in Alaska. Korean bank would establish a branch in Anchorage. That would not be possible for a bank from another state.
Do you have any indication that somebody might be interested in doing that?
I mentioned that Korean bank did want to do that one time, and one of the financial managers from Tokyo said that they did have an interest in setting up an office in Anchorage at one time. However, the Tokyo branch in Seattle convinced Tokyo that they could handle it nicely from Seattle. But we've had talks in that regard. We've had people tell us that they're interested in it, but we've never had anybody approach us with the application.
The distinction that exists there is that international banks will be allowed to establish branches. Interstate banks from other states would not be allowed to establish branches, but would instead have to purchase a branch, an existing bank up here. Interstate banks would also require that there be reciprocity with the home state of the bank. If a Washington bank wants to purchase a branch in Alaska and is able to make a deal with an Alaskan bank to purchase that branch, the first question that the division would be required to ask is, would an Alaska bank have the same right to go down to Washington and buy a branch of a Washington bank? Would Washington law permit that? And the requirement would be that there be that reciprocity open so that it's not a competitive disadvantage to Alaska banks as opposed to other states. FDIC insurance would be required for interstate banks. And again, I mean, now this raises an interesting question that we'll get into later. The recodification proposal actually allows for a waiver of FDIC insurance for Alaskan banks. And we'll also talk a little bit more about that when we get there, but the philosophy behind that. But in certain circumstances, with department approval and with protection for depositors, FDIC insurance might be waived for a particular bank. If a bank from another state, though, is coming in here to branch, the proposed statute requires that interstate bank have FDIC insurance. The same is not true, however, for international banks. Obviously, an international bank can't necessarily get FDIC insurance. I'm not even sure the way the FDIC rules operate, but I'm not sure that the Tokyo bank can even get FDIC insurance. Instead, though, what it requires is that bank maintain assets in the state sufficient to cover 100% of all depositors. And so if there became a problem with that particular international bank, the state would have a right to take those assets and pay off all depositors to the tune of 100%, so full protection of depositors' costs. And finally, any branches of interstate or
is that it's really difficult. If you have to imagine yourself, you know, a limited market as a banker. And one of the things that you're confronted with is competition invading your territory without the ability to respond to that competition. What this creates that we have confined the regulatory industry is that in order, and this is preceded by a necessity by some, in order to meet the requirements of your shareholders and earnings, you take additional risk. What we're trying to say here is that if the management of the bank is such that it can demonstrate that it can do other things, whether it be allied to the banking industry or separate from the banking industry as a profit center, they can, with certain limitations, take advantage of those. The main thing that we want now is that we want a bank to be able to have a subsidiary for the banking businesses that it can't do. In other words, we want to make sure that if the bank has a trust department, which is a bank function, that bank can, if it makes a management decision, form a trust subsidiary. It would be the same management, it would be the same bank, it would be the same regulation, but the management would make a decision that on its balance sheet it would show better or operate better as a separate profit center or expense center, a separate operational center than the bank itself. So we're asking that we be allowed to let banks have those type of subsidiaries that the bank can do in its normal banking business. Then the second step, if a bank has in its locale, say that it is in an area that does not have services, either a title company or insurance coverage or some other type of situation, that a management and the bank can demonstrate that it can set up a subsidiary outside the bank, that to do those things, they could apply for authority to do those things from the state of Alaska. To give you an example, Lower Studwell, when we had Arctic City's law, which was a federal charter, in Fairbanks, one way that they could get a motel in, I think it was Delvin Junction, is the Arctic Savings loan formed a service corporation with other outside investors and built a motel in Delvin Junction along the highway or someplace. Those type of things provide some return to the financial institution as a separate subsidiary, but it also provides some benefits to the community. There is an assumption when you read the proposed code that there aren't any federal prohibitions. Today, there are federal prohibitions and a lot of things that banks do, but give an example of an insurance agency. The state of Oregon allows banks to have an insurance agency subsidiary. It is up to FDIC and the state of Oregon. The insuring agency will also step in and say, well, is this a risk to their insuring fund by allowing this subsidiary? So where there's an implication that there may be some federal prohibition for some of these subsidiary actions, we're taking an aggressive point of
being is that the Feds, or national banks, the OCC, kept adopting lower and lower, I don't know if you want to use the word standards, but different standards, looser standards, lending standards for national banks. And to be competitive, the state banks kept saying we need to be able to lend on a par equal with national banks. And to do so, the division adopted regulations repeatedly. What this code has done is there are, I
different individuals of the company started approaching the bank and saying, when you need the money based upon my separate loan, and I will apply that to finish out the Jordan Creek Mall. We had difficulty under the existing banking code at that time to say that that is an affiliated business that you're, that is actually one borrower. And what happened, what we perceived to happen, materialized. They had so much expense to the construction of the mall that there wasn't enough income from the mall to pay back the loan. Thus, the loan went into default. The lead lender on that was Rainier Bank, and Rainier Bank is, they had to go into the, had to go into the management and the ownership of that loan. The point that we're trying to do here is that there are recognitions of problems when you try to skirt around the ability of a borrower on a particular loan and exceed the limits to that borrower, that there are inherent risks in that loan. And so we're trying to sort of clean that up. In essence, it's parity with the federal government in this situation, but it's not a parity in retail, it's a parity in regulations. They have a lot of case law that have established loans to one borrower, and so this addresses only the state chartered banks and their lending ability to any particular associated borrowers for the project.
In general, this is your codification.